This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Happy New Year! Later this hour, a sci-fi classic. We connect the origins of humanity through science and art in a conversation with novelist Cormac McCarthy, filmmaker Werner Herzog, and physicist Lawrence Krauss. But first, you get a seat on stage for a special event recorded at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and yes, right, all the children are above average. That's the home, of course, of A Prairie Home Companion. The theme of this night, though, last fall, was the science of superpowers. University of Minnesota physicist James Kakalios unmasked the science behind some of your favorite superheroes. He joined us as our expert judge for our superhero science quiz. So get your pencils ready as the curtain comes up. Science and scientists are inspired by fiction and fictional heroes, superheroes, and all of us who love superheroes are continually arguing, who is the best comic book superhero, right? What is the greatest superpower? Mine's better than yours, all that kind of stuff. Well, is it Superman's ability to fly and his super strength? Maybe Jean Grey and her telepathic powers? Or Mr. Midnight's ability to stop clocks from ticking? You remember Mr. Midnight? He only lasted for two stories. Not everybody remembers him. So right here on our stage, we're going to unmask the science behind these superpowers and see how they all stack up. And we're going to test your superhero science IQ. My next guest has analyzed the world of superheroes and has crunched the numbers behind their powers. James Kakalios is a professor of physics at the University of Minnesota, author of the book, The Physics of Superheroes. Welcome. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Ira.
Good to have you, Jim.
You've expanded the studio from the last time I was here.
Well, you grew up reading comic books, right?
I did. I read comics as a kid. I gave them up in high school upon discovering girls.
You had priorities.
A discovery I'm not given enough credit for in the scientific literature, but
So when did you get hooked on the science part of the comics?
Well, I picked up actually the hobby of reading comic books back in graduate school, just as a way of relieving stress working on my dissertation. As a professor at the University of Minnesota, I started bringing in superhero examples into my freshman introductory physics classes, because this will come as a shock to you, Ira, but some of my students actually find physics dull.
No.
I know.
I'm shocked.
I know.
Very shocked.
And they always complain, when am I ever going to use this in my real life? Interestingly enough, whenever I use superheroes to illustrate physics principles, students never wonder when they're going to use this in their real life. And apparently they all have plans after graduation that involve spandex. And
Do you still do research?
Oh, absolutely.
Research? Yeah?
Yes.
What kind of research do you do?
I do work. My research actually goes from the nano to the neuro. So we make nanocrystals of silicon. We embed them into other types of semiconductors to make better transistors or solar cells. And we use techniques we developed to study electronic noise in semiconductors and collaborate with neuroscientists to study voltage fluctuations in the brain.
Wow.
But that's not why I'm here today.
Well, I want you to think hard. I want you to think hard before you answer this question. And that is, which is it harder to work out, the physics of the semiconductors or the physics of the superheroes?
To some extent, the superheroes are a little bit more open-ended because we can't always just go to experiment to resolve a question.
No.
I would say that in some sense, they're almost the same, because in both cases, you're challenging your preconceptions and you're asking what if.
All right. We're going to get into this, and we're going to play our game. Can you hang out a little bit longer? Jim
Absolutely.
Is going to be our judge. Are you all ready to play our quiz? Superheroes, they can blast lasers from their eyes. They can leap tall buildings in a single bound. But what is the science behind all of these superheroes?
Absolutely.
How well do you know, in the audience, the physics of superheroes? We're going to test your knowledge along with the contestants that we have on our stage. So if you're all ready to play, everybody, Annie Minoff is helping us with our official timekeeping and scorekeeping. Let me introduce you all to Annie Minoff. Hi, Annie.
Hello, Ira.
Hey there. Give us an idea what those valuable prizes are.
The winners will get a Sci-Fry swag bag with a Sci-Fry t-shirt and tote bag.
I don't even have one of those. Something wrong here. Okay. All right, let's meet our teams. When you think about science in the Twin Cities, of course, one of the big innovations that pops into your mind is the Post-it note, right? That's 3M. Our first team is made up of scientists from 3M. Welcome, Team 3M. Please get up to the mic and introduce yourselves.
I'm Ainsley Grant, and I work in the Renewable Energy Division at 3M. And we use material solutions to help make power, basically. We build solar panels, we work on wind turbines, and we just apply science to life.
Wow. Wow. And you, sir?
Yep. My name is Vasav Sani. I work at 3M2 in corporate research. And I work in a new field called biomimicry, where I take inspiration from nature and particularly spiders to create products that you use in day-to-day life.
Wow.
That's really science applied to life.
Two real nerds. That's good to have you
thank
here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Good to have you here. Hey, look, I count myself amongst you. Now, who could do battle? How would we battle the wits of research scientists? We wanted a team that really knew their superhero stuff. Our second team is from the Convergence Convention. That's an annual science fiction and fantasy gathering that happens right here in the Twin Cities that I'm sure you know about. Welcome, Team Convergence, to the quiz.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourselves to our audience.
Sure. Hi, I'm Tim Wick. I am a playwright and comedian.
And?
I'm also the Green Lantern. Green Lantern.
My name is Brianne Villieu, and I am a Convergence attendee, and for my day job, I am a development scientist.
Very nice. Very nice. Thank you. Okay, a couple of ground rules before we begin. First, we want you to participate in the audience. If you want to react with applause, that's fine. And as they say in the quiz shows, though, rule number two is our judge's decision is final. No arguing with the judges. We don't have instant replay to actually go back on it. All right, here's how we're going to play. We're going to show a movie clip, and then we're going to ask our question based on that clip. Both teams will have 15 seconds to answer the question. They have those little whiteboards that they're going to write down the questions, the answers on the whiteboards. We might, if we think it, we don't understand why you chose something, we might ask you to explain the answer that you gave to us. The good news is that the questions get harder as we go on. But the good news, why that's good news is because they're worth more points. So if you're, you know, if you're behind in the score and you get a question later, you could catch up and win the game. So that's the good news about it. And everybody in the audience, you're going to see the questions. You can play along, but don't shout out the answers, please. You'll embarrass yourself when it's wrong, and we don't want that to happen. Are we all ready to go? Everybody ready to play? Okay. All right, let's go to question number one. It's worth 1 point. Gee, we spent a lot of money on this one, I can say. In Watchmen, physicist John Osterman is accidentally trapped inside a nuclear test chamber. After he reassembles his molecules back together, he reemerges as the aptly named superhero Dr. Manhattan. Why it's Manhattan, not Brooklyn, I don't know. Anyhow, he has superpowers any physicist could envy, like controlling matter and energy, as you can see in this clip.
If Adrian and I can solve the energy crisis, war may be averted.
But you always say that time is simultaneous. If that's true, then how can you change the future?
If only you could perceive time as I do.
Very spooky. Now for the question. Not only is Dr. Manhattan bigger and better, but as you can see from the clip, he's also bluer. And that glowing blue color is really, it's a real phenomenon. You can see it in a reactor pool at a nuclear reactor. The effect is due to particles going faster than the speed of light in water. So the question is, what is the name of the phenomenon? Is it called the Putin process, the Cherenkov radiation, circle of turn-off effect, or Oppenheimer scattering. Here's a little hint. It's named after a Russian scientist who first experimentally detected it. Write down your answers. You've got 15 seconds. Go.
Five seconds remaining.
Beulah the Buzzer. How many remember Beulah the Buzzer? You remember her? Yes. Time's up. Let's go to Team 3M first. Team 3M, what's your answer? You said,
D.
Oppenheimer scattering. Why did you say that?
It looks like... Okay.
Yeah.
So, because the particles are going faster than light in water, and so it's some sort of scattering.
That's okay. All right. And let's go to this team. What did you write?
You said B.
B. You said B.
I said not to shout out the answer.
No one's listening.
That's what we said.
And the correct answer is B, Cherenkov radiation.
Why, Jim?
Right.
Why is that the
right.
correct answer?
So just as if when a jet plane moves in air faster than the air can move, namely the speed of sound, it creates a shock front. When light travels actually slower in water than it does in air or the vacuum of space. And so when a charged particle, such as an electron, travels faster than light can travel, it creates a shock front and emits ultraviolet and violet and blue light. And what we see is the blue light. It's basically a photon sonic boom that's being created by the electrons traveling faster than light can travel in the water.
And that's why he's blue.
He's, well, and perhaps he should consider putting some clothes on, yeah.
Yeah. That's above our pay grade to decide I think. All right, Annie, what's the score?
3M is trailing with 0 points, and Convergence is in the lead with 1 point.
After the break, more of our Science Friday superhero quiz recorded live in St. Paul, Minnesota. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now back to the Science Friday superhero quiz recorded live at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul. Physicist James Kakalios is our judge. Teams from 3M and sci-fi superfans are battling it out on stage. Producer Annie Minoff is the official timekeeper and scorekeeper. And since this is radio and you can't see the stage, I'm going to pop in here and there to fill you in as needed. Now on with the show. This is our live Science Friday superhero quiz. Let's go on to question number 2. Don't forget that you get to be worth more points. And now here's question number 2. Thank you. Paid a lot of money for that thing. We've got to use it. Now that we've looked at radioactive scientists, what about radioactive turtles? I know you're ahead of me on this. Don't get too far ahead of it. You all remember Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, right? And in this clip, Master Splinter shares the origin of the crime-fighting turtles.
When we were forced to come to New York, I found myself, for the first time, without a home, wandering the sewers, scavenging for whatever I could find. And then, one day, I came upon a shattered glass jar, and 4 baby turtles. The little ones were crawling into a strange glowing ooze from a broken canister nearby. I gathered them up in an old coffee can, and when I awoke the next morning, I received a shock. I was amazed at how intelligent they seemed, but nothing could have prepared me for what happened next. One of them spoke.
Pizza! Pizza!
Ah, that's what I would have said after crawling out of the ooze.
In the sewer.
In the sewer. Yeah.
Maybe that's Pizza Rat.
That's Pizza Rat. That's right. Absolutely. You know, The rat seemed to be like the Yoda from old days. this September, biologist David Gruber actually spotted a glowing turtle swimming in the Solomon Islands. But the glow was not caused by radioactive ooze, I'm happy to say. And here is the question. Now, to repeat, Dr. Gruber shined a UV light on the turtle. Its shell was able to absorb the blue photons, transform it, and emit it back as yellow. What is the name of this process? Is the answer bioluminescence, radioactive decay, turtle auroras, biofluorescence? You have 15 seconds starting now.
You're the biologist.
I think it's so high.
I'm testing you.
Jellyfish. 5 seconds remaining.
Markers down. The two most feared words in school, right? Ever. Pencils down. All right, let's see. We're going to start with Team Convergence this time. What's your guess? You're going to guess?
D.
D, which is biofluorescence.
Yes.
Okay, any reason why you chose that?
Yeah.
I thought it was A or D, but luminescence would be like self-emitting, and fluorescence is a reaction with another light.
Wow, you should be sitting in the seat here. Let's see.
We'll see if it's right.
Told you, steam got the A for the stem there. What was your answer?
We said D as well.
For what reason did you say D?
Similarly, that luminescence is like glowing versus fluorescence is like emitting.
Absorbing.
Jim, could you tell us?
And the correct answer is D, biofluorescence.
Yay.
Yep. For exactly the reason they said, that when something fluoresces, you shine light on it, and then it emits a different type of light. That's right.
All right. Wow. So,
and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are, of course, a great inspiration. They provide an example, as if we needed another example, of the positive benefits of wallowing in radioactive waste.
I know. Their star is at Chernobyl, so... All right, Annie, what's the score?
Well, 3M has 2 points, and Convergence is still slightly in the lead with 3.
Whoa. All right, let's move on to question number 3. This is worth 3 points. All right.
Money's worth.
This next question comes from the X-Men. Cyclops' mutant superpowers lets him blast optic beams from his ruby quartz lenses, obliterating anything in its way. Shooting beams from your eyes like a high-powered gun might work in the X-Men universe, but in this scene, Cyclops defies a law of physics here in our world. We want to know, what law of physics does Cyclops break in this scene? Tell us what is inaccurate, scientifically inaccurate, in this clip.
Shoot on sight!
You might remember this scene. A group of X-Men are chased by gunmen and cornered. Cyclops, guided by Emma Frost, runs out and blasts an optic beam, taking out a huge glass window and all of the gunmen.
Did I get him?
Yeah.
Whoa. If I had to answer that question, I'd say they never run out of bullets. And that's got to be scientifically inaccurate. The question is, what is scientifically inaccurate in the clip that we just saw? What scientific principle is being violated?
Right.
There you go. 15 seconds, go.
Is it our turn?
Yeah, everybody write it down.
Both of you.
What?
Yeah.
Five seconds remaining.
All right, let's go to this team, the Convergence team, first. What is being violated?
Newton's third law. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
What do you guys think on the audience?
Yeah.
That one, yeah?
Yep. I would say that.
Let me ask this team.
Well, we were thinking of the first law of thermodynamics because they're creating energy.
They're creating energy out of no energy.
Out of no energy.
Out of their eyeballs.
Yeah. Exactly.
His eyeball. Eyeball.
What's that? One eyeball. That's right. You see how much I follow this.
You mentioned it.
Jim?
Well, that's actually a good point, that But certainly the superpowers themselves violate conservation of energy on a regular basis. I was thinking more in a mechanistic point of view about conservation of momentum and the third law. I might have to say I'll give it to both of them.
Both of them, okay.
A judge's call.
Yeah.
I will.
Because if they really shot those things out of his eyes that quickly, he'd be shot across the room.
Yeah, no, right. He obviously has two superpowers, force beams from his eyes, and exceptionally strong neck muscles.
Okay. You don't hear about that very much. Okay. Annie, what's
neck
our
man.
Score?
Well, 3M has 5 points now. Convergence still slightly in the lead with 6.
Whoa. Oh, so we now move on to the could be a tiebreaker. You can still come from behind when we move on to question number 4, which is worth 4 points. It's anyone's game.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Here we go. When Scott Lang, also known as Ant-Man, puts on his special suit, he can shrink down to the size of an ant while still keeping in his human strength. I know you're asking why turning tiny would come in handy, right? That's what I have. With this clip, you're going to see one of the reasons.
In this scene, Ant-Man, in his tiny size, leaps onto the barrel of the gun of the bad guys, jumps onto a model of the city, and he speeds between miniature skyscrapers, dodging bullets along the way.
That's not supposed to be funny. You're all laughing. This guy's running away for his life.
That was stupid scary.
This is pretty scary. Not only like the budget for broken glass in Hollywood movies is something must be exorbitant. Now the final question is, we want to know, how far can Ant-Man jump according to physics? Let me give you some stats. Scott was originally 6 feet tall and has been shrunk to half an inch. That means he is 1/144th his original size. That's 1/144. And remember, he keeps his human strength at this tiny size. So knowing that, how far could Ant-Man jump and why? Here are your choices. A, he would be able to jump the same distance as normal-sized Scott. B, he would be able to jump 1/144th the distance of normal Scott. C, he would be able to jump 144 times further than normal Scott. 15 seconds starts now.
Five seconds remaining.
Time's up. Let me ask the audience. Everybody's done writing down?
Yeah.
Audience, what do you think? C, B? Who says C?
C,
who says B? Who says I don't know? Well, there you go. There you go. Most of the audience. All right, let's go over to the 3M side this time. What have you guys?
We are guessing A.
You're guessing A? Just a guess. You had support in the audience there for A. Just a guess. Okay, let's go over to you guys. What do you think?
We guess C.
C because?
Because he can jump. He has the same strength, but he's considerably lighter when he's that small.
Ooh. Jim Kakalios.
Okay, but the question is, what do we mean by strength, right? When you lift something up, you're using your muscles. The strength of your muscles comes from the cross-sectional area. If he's shrunk down, he's got much smaller muscles. But then, of course, his mass is much lighter when he's reduced. Presumably, he reduced at constant density so that when he sits on an ant, he doesn't squish the ant, makes Antony paste or anything. So his muscles are weaker as at a reduced size, but his mass is reduced. And so if you could jump several feet when normal size, an ant can jump several feet. We think if you could scale the ant up to a human size, you'd be able to jump several stories. But really what you'd be able to do is still jump several feet. So the correct answer is A.
Hey.
Oh, that was the one.
Wow. Yeah, it was a guess. Pure guess.
Right.
Pure guess. Better to be lucky than good.
Yeah, yeah, that's what you were thinking. Yeah, right.
You know, it works on the SATs for me. You know, that was it. Annie, what's the final score?
Well, 3M has pulled into the lead with 9 points, and Convergence earned 6.
The winner, 3M. And what is that? Remind us, Annie, what the fabulous prize they're going to walk home with is?
Well, the winners will get a Sci-Fry swag bag with a Sci-Fry T-shirt and tote bag.
Whoa! Thank you all. Thanks, James Kakalias, for giving us a lesson in superhero
pleasure.
Science, fact, and fiction. Let's congratulate both of our teams for playing.
That was Science Friday's live superhero quiz, recorded at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota, last fall. Albert Einstein once wrote, "The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science." Well, back in April 2011, I sat down for an enlightening conversation with three big thinkers about art, science, and the mysterious place where they intersect. Filmmaker Werner Herzog, novelist Cormac McCarthy, and physicist Lawrence Krauss joined me from Tempe, Arizona, where they'd gathered for Arizona State University's Origins Science and Culture Festival. Our conversation was really wide-ranging. It took us from the Chauvet Cave in France, setting for Herzog's film Cave of Forgotten Dreams, to the frightening dystopia of the novel The Road by Cormac McCarthy, to the outer reaches of the cosmos. We won't be taking your calls this hour, but you can tweet us at SciFry. Our conversation kicked off when I asked Lawrence Krauss where he saw the intersection of art and science.
Well, to me, it's kind of obvious. They asked the same questions. Science addresses... Really, what it does at its best is force us to reassess our place in the cosmos. Who are we? Where are we going? And those are the very same questions that you get in art, literature, music. Every time you read a wonderful book or see a wonderful film, you come out of it with a different perspective of yourself. And they come together in some sense in the notion of origins. Origins really is one place where it seems to me those two worlds connect the closest, because we all wonder about our origins in different ways. And it's the forefront of science in almost every field, and yet, of course, it's really what we're asking ourselves when we think about literature and art.
Werner, you always seem to have that kind of connection in the films that you make. Certainly, you get into the science, and then you get into a larger question.
Well, in some of the films, yes, but it doesn't really apply to everything I do. But a good example of what you are alluding to is the most recent film in the cave in southern France, where you really can observe the origins of the modern human soul, so to speak. Art, figurative representation. There was music nearby. Ivory flutes were found. And just phenomenal things that did not occur to Neanderthal men who roamed the landscape at the same time 32,000 years ago. So there are profound questions and, of course, profound mysteries remaining.
Cormac McCarthy, most people may not know this, but I understand you are very interested in science also. Tell us about your relationship, for example, with the Santa Fe Institute.
Well, I met Murray Gell-Mann about 25 years ago, and I'd been interested in science at that time, particularly physics, and I was invited to come to the Santa Fe Institute, where I've been for, about a dozen years. But my connection with them was even before that, and I think it kind of helps you to stay honest. You're talking about things which are factual and things about which there is agreement. It's kind of hard to get agreement about the arts, but if you're talking about a theory in physics, guess what? It's either true or it's not, and I kind of like that.
We have to take a short break. When we come back, a novelist, a physicist, and a filmmaker contemplate the end of humanity. Hmm. More from my 2011 conversation with Werner Herzog, Cormac McCarthy, and Lawrence Krauss. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You're listening this hour to a conversation from April 2011 with novelist Cormac McCarthy, physicist Lawrence Krauss, and filmmaker Werner Herzog, talking about the mysterious intersection of art and science. Herzog was fresh off the release of his documentary film Cave of Forgotten Dreams, filmed in the Chauvet Cave in southern France, a stunning meditation on art, science, and human origins. We won't be taking your calls this hour, but you can get in the conversation by tweeting at SciFry. Our conversation picks up with my question to Cormac McCarthy, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Road. Cormac, when you hang around scientists, do they make you optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, some of my friends would probably tell you that making me pessimistic would be a difficult chore indeed. But I'm not, I don't know. I'm pessimistic about a lot of things. But as Lawrence has quoted me as saying, it's no reason to be miserable about it.
That's one of my favorite quotes.
The other thing we talked about a few minutes ago was how bad we are at prognostication. So the fact that I take a pretty dreary view of the future is cheering, because I think, you know, the chances are that I'm wrong.
Well, certainly reading The Road, one hopes so, that you're wrong about that future scenario.
I think Cormac is not wrong, because it's quite evident that human beings as a species will vanish and fairly quickly. When I say quickly, it may be in 2,000-3,000 years, maybe 30,000 years, maybe 300,000, but not much more, because we are much more vulnerable than other species, despite a certain amount of intelligence. It doesn't make me nervous that fairly soon we'll have a planet which doesn't contain human beings.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I flip back and forth as a scientist between, you know, I think on there are days when I don't know whether I've ever imagined a future quite as bleak as The Road, but maybe, because I think humanity as an ensemble hasn't demonstrated a lot of intelligence about behaving in a way that globally impacts on the planet in a healthy way. But at the same time, I agree with Werner, but I'm not so sure we'll vanish because we destroyed ourselves. We may vanish.
I'm not speaking of self-destruction, which could happen, of course, but there are many events thinkable out there which would instantly wipe us out.
Oh, absolutely. That's likely to happen. That will inevitably happen anyway. But I think there may be a rosier future. Let me throw one thing in, which I've talked about the fact that, you know, we imagine we are the pinnacle of evolution. But I doubt that's the case. And I think it's quite clear to me in the long run that I think computers will one day be, if we persist as a species to develop them, will one day become self-aware and conscious. And it'll be obvious to me that they're probably much superior to us. And biology will have to, in some way, adapt to them. And you know, the movies always show the computers as being bad, but I don't know why that would be the case. If they're self-aware, I doubt they'll be any worse than we are. And my friend Frank Wilczek he wants to know if they do physics the same way. So I think, you know, we may disappear as a species just because we become irrelevant as well as being destroyed. But I don't think that's a bad thing. That may be the future. I think where I really would agree with Werner said in some sense is that we shouldn't be, and with Cormac, we shouldn't be depressed if we disappear. We should be thrilled that we're here right now. I see no purpose in the universe from science, and that doesn't depress me. That just means we should make the most of our brief moment in the sun.
Mm-hmm. We have a question here from a listener who called in asking about both of you, and he's wondering where some of your ideas come from, and he gave us this little phone clip.
Hello, this is Ciarán in Galway. My question is to both Cormac McCarthy and Werner Herzog. Both of you have created works of art in which the universe is depicted as harsh, unforgiving, and indifferent to human concerns. To what extent is such a vision shaped by scientific ideas? And does complexity science offer us a different view of our place in the universe?
Well, there you go. Cormac, what is complexity science?
Well, we talked about that coming over. I don't think you can ask any 10 people in science what complexity is and get a consistent view. As far as painting the world as grim, I don't know. If you look at classical literature, the core of literature is the idea of tragedy. You know, you don't really learn much from the good things that happen to you. But tragedy is at the core of human experience, and it's what we have to deal with. That's what makes life difficult, and that's what we want to know about. It's what we want to know how to deal with it. It's unavoidable. There's nothing you can do to forestall it. So how do you deal with it? And all classical literature has to do with things to happen that happen to people they would really rather hadn't.
Werner, let's talk about your latest film.
Well, I'd like to answer the question,
sure.
Part of the question first, because there was an interesting aspect in it at the end. Our place in the universe, it is here, and that's the place we have in nothing else. Everything else is unfriendly. We cannot flee from our planet. I mean, go to any other planet in the solar system. It's just not inviting. And the next planet from there, the next star out there is only 4.5 light years away, but with the fastest speed we can ever reach so far, it would take 110,000 years just to go there. Hundreds and hundreds of generations, they wouldn't even know where they were going. There would be incest and madness and murder and whatever en route. So it's not pleasant to move. And Lawrence, I hope you agree, we cannot dissolve into particles of light like in Star Trek and beam ourselves somewhere.
I wish we could. Every time I'm in an airport terminal, I wish I could.
This is our place. This is our place, and we better take care of it. And sometimes, of course, you can be disgruntled in a way. For example, I've worked in the jungle and... after real hardship, I came to the conclusion, yes, I love the jungle. However, against my better judgment.
your new film shows the triumph of the human. A synopsis of it, Werner, how would you, for people just tuning in, what would you say the film is?
Well, it is... looking into a deep abyss of time with a camera, going into the cave. Probably nobody will ever be allowed again because I think they will shut it down, like Lascaux, the most famous so far, because too many human beings in there left a mold, the exhalation, the breath of humans left a mold on the walls that cannot be controlled easily. So it's just... penetration into an abyss.
You could visit them with naval rebreathers.
Where are they located, the caves?
It's one cave with two branches. It is in the south of France, not very far from the Rhône River in the gorge of the Ardèche River. You have to check it out on a map, but it's southern France.
And they believe, from watching your film, that they believe there may be more of these caves that are...
Well, we can speculate. Maybe, hopefully, would be great. Mm-hmm. But we don't know.
I want to play a little clip from your film. This clip describes the reaction of one of the scientists talking about his experience in this magnificent cave.
The first time I entered to show the cave, I had the chance to get in during 5 days. And it was so powerful that every night I was dreaming of lions. And every day was the same shock for me. It was an emotional shock. I mean, I'm a scientist, but a human too. And after 5 days, I decided not to go back in the cave because I needed time just to relax and take time
to absorb it.
Yeah.
Wow. Werner, who was that scientist?
Well, a younger generation archaeologist who was very fascinating because he started his career as a circus man. And I immediately asked him a lion tame, and no, he was a juggler in a unicycle.
Yes.
But very, very fascinating people there.
Lawrence, you have a reaction to that?
Well, yeah, I think it's I really related to what that scientist was saying. In some sense, what you don't realize is sometimes when you try and confront the real world, as a scientist, it's terrifying because it forces you to throw away a lot of things you believe. And sometimes you have to go away from it. And I think that's what I mean. I think the convergence of science and art in the sense that what that scientist was saying, it was confronted with the reality of those caves. It was difficult for him to deal with. And even as a theoretical physicist, sometimes just alone at night, confronted with the possibility that the real universe might actually correspond to something you're thinking about, is terrifying.
It is, because it's not friendly. Just imagine to be being sucked into a black hole, or even landing on the sun, which looks so benign and beautiful, and there's hundreds of thousands of atomic explosions boiling every second.
And in some ways, we have to realize that. Yeah, well, once again, we have to confront our own, in some sense, an unfriendly universe potentially, but also our own insignificance in a cosmic sense, and what significance we make of ourselves is, to me, part of it is our ability to, this amazing gift we have to appreciate the universe and imagine it not just as it is, but as it might be, in order to understand ourselves better. That's why I find this connection.
Do you think when you bring scientists and artists and writers together, they actually inspire each other, give each other ideas?
Well, these two gentlemen have inspired me for many years in many different ways, so there's no doubt about it. I can say I'm inspired. They can speak for themselves.
Well, for me, for example, a film like Fitzcarraldo, where I moved a huge ship over a mountain in the Amazon jungle, actually started out in Brittany at the northwestern coast of France, where you have dolmens and menhirs, Neolithic huge slabs of stone erected, but there are thousands of them in parallel rows. And I was sitting there and I tried to figure out how would I do it as a Neolithic person without the modern machinery. And of course, I came up with a method which in essence is how I moved the ship over the mountain. Mm-hmm. And it made me very angry because a pseudo scientist had postulated that these stones were so heavy that only ancient astronauts from different planets could have done it. And I thought this is so completely and utterly idiotic. It just itched me, and I wanted to find out, and it led to a way how to move a ship over a mountain. Mm-hmm.
I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI. Cormac, have you ever, being there at the Santa Fe Institute, do you ever, in your great facility with the English language, find yourself turning some of those research papers into better ones before they're published?
Oh, I do. I fight with them all the time. I say you have to get rid of these exclamation points and these semicolons. I won't speak to you until you do.
I have to say that Cormac phoned me. We spoke on the phone about my book, and he said, I've got it, and there's some suggestions I want to make for the next edition, but you have to get rid of all your exclamation marks.
But we should go straight at Lawrence's jugular.
Oh, great.
Because only 2 days ago, a day ago, there was reports of a mysterious finding, possibly even a new form of force in the universe. And we just want to know what do you think about it,
Lawrence? Do you want to fill us in on that?
Well, it's a fascinating, a tantalizing bump seen at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, statistical bump, and if it's true, it means much of what we think about the fundamental forces nature is wrong, which is probably not true, and we were just talking about that before. It's exciting. But we have to realize that we have to wait and see, and most of our ideas are wrong. And so the most exciting thing would be if this bump that shouldn't be there is there, because it means most of our ideas are wrong. And if you're a theoretical physicist, that's exactly what you want to be the case, because it means there's a lot more out there to discover.
I hope they're wrong. I hope they're wrong, because I feel comfortable with the explanation of forces.
What bump? Well, give us an idea. Lawrence, what do you mean by a bump that's there?
Well, what the... Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory does in the Tevatron, which was, until the Large Hadron Collider, the most energetic accelerator in the world, is bangs together protons and antiprotons together, smashes them together, and sees what comes out, measuring the energy of the particles and the different and their charges. And if a particle is created that lives for a little while and then decays, what you'll see is a lot of particles coming out, but all with the energy of, associated with the mass of the particle that decays. So if you're looking to discover new particles, you look at the energy of the particles coming out, and you see if they all happen to lie in a very small region. That means there's probably some intermediate particle that was created that lives for a while and then decays. And that's statistically what they've seen at a tantalizing level. The Large Hadron Collider, of course, will explore it. And
it doesn't, it doesn't fit theory anywhere?
It doesn't fit theory anywhere. And in fact, the interesting thing is that Werner said he hopes it's wrong, because I kind of feel like him in the jungle, because I want it to be wrong, even though I know it's probably not good for me.
Gentlemen, yeah, we've run out of time. Can we invite you back next time, same place?
I'd
same
love it.
Same station?
Yes.
Okay.
We'll talk.
We'll talk. Thank you all. Werner Herzog is a film director, producer, and screenwriter. He has directed over 50 films, you know, Grizzly Man and Encounters at the End of the World. Cormac McCarthy, what can I say about him? He's a novelist and a playwright. His books include The Road, No Country for Old Men, All the Pretty Horses, and now it sounds like he knows more about science than we thought he did. He's letting us know about that. Lawrence Krauss is a physicist, foundation professor, and director of the ASU Origins Project. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. We'll meet you back here a year from now.
Thank you, Ira.
Thanks, Ira.
Cormac McCarthy, Lawrence Krauss, and Werner Herzog speaking with me back in April of 2011. Some big ideas from the Sci-Fi archives as we head into 2016. Oh, yeah, and that mysterious bump Lawrence described at Fermilab, it was not a new particle. Werner Herzog got his way. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Graskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Wishing you a very happy new year from all of us at Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.